the common fescue variety that causes the problem is Kentucky 31. And it gets its name from of how it was founded and when it was distributed. And for years, this grass provided a phenomenal resource to the producers. It's a very drought tolerant grass. It's a heat tolerant grass. And it resists a lot of herbivory. And so it is one that a lot of producers use because it's green 75% of the year and it'll grow in this area. It wasn't until I think the late 70s that they associated that the reason this grass is so persistent, and you know, I jokingly say it's the super grass of the South because of how well it does, is because it contains a fungus. And that fungus is what gives this grass its superpowers.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lalamond Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm Travis Molinix, and today I'm lucky to have Dr. Daniel Full on the podcast. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir.
So Dr. Full is a full professor at NC State, studies reproductive management and just beef cattle, correct?
Yeah, doing a lot of production-based reproductive management.
Yep, a lot of focus on fescue and the challenges with fescue in the Southeast. That's a massive challenge on the reproductive end for a lot of producers.
Yeah, so it was really interesting. Not from the North Carolina region originally, and when we got recruited down here, a colleague of mine shared with me some of his experiences from decades of research and really intrigued me that we've had this problem in the Southeast and across the country for years. And not to insult anybody, but we put a Band-Aid on the problem and have tried to fix it with Band-Aids, but really struggled to figure out what is the driving force or what is that key thing that's causing these challenges. And from there, got really excited and said, hey, here's an area that I think I can jump in, help some producers and try to answer some questions in a little bit different mindset than we have in the past.
Yeah, to give the audience a background of you've been at NC State for what, 12, 15 years?
Yeah, going on, I think this is year 14. I started in 2011. And before coming down here to NC State, I did what I call the tour of the region at West Virginia University, the Ohio State University, and then Penn State University. So grew up in southwestern Pennsylvania, and in the upper, you know, Appalachian Mountains there, and small diversified farm. And my folks worked off the farm, and so it was not the primary source of income. So we had to do a lot of little things different. My dad worked at the steel mills and my mom was a healthcare worker. And so having two younger brothers, us boys did a lot of the farming on our own and learned a lot of good lessons that way. And then ended up going to West Virginia University for my bachelor's. And while I was there, was very fortunate to interact with Dr. Inskeep and Dr. Daly. And Dr. Daly was willing to take me on and sort of polish me up a little bit with a master's and did a very applied master's where we were looking at how do we improve pregnancy rates in artificially inseminated cattle. But we are doing it through the immune system and how do we trick the immune system to allow that to happen? And he really got me excited, gave me the ability to think. And, from there went to work with Dr. Joy Pate at Ohio State, who was doing more on the immune side. And, I joke and say that I've took more immunology courses than repro courses during my PhD, because it was a completely unexplored area for us. And so I was able to look at some of the cell to cell stuff and, you know, continue to add those tools to my belt, which took me to a postdoc at Penn State. And actually I went into, the poultry science department when it was still there at Penn State University, and went even more molecular. So from a very applied background, narrowing it down, into getting into manipulating the genes, of the chicken ovary. Why I went poultry is I wanted to learn more about follicular genesis and why not study a species that ovulates every day. And so, went that different route. But really, you know, going back to some of the influences I had as a kid, it was, you know, our involvement with our extension, and so forth that really drove me to seek a position that allowed me to have the ability to work with producers, work with youth groups and educate that next generation. And when I interviewed at North Carolina State University, the positions of teaching research split and really felt at home when I interviewed and was very thankful to be able to join the faculty down here. And then, like I said, continue to explore some things that directly impact our beef cattle producers.
Oh, that's great. You know, and that's a very wide depth of area, you know, going from your master's to postdoc that, you know, it's a very well-rounded that allows you to look at, especially some of these issues with fescue and at a different level.
Yep. It was funny. I went back and gave a talk at West Virginia University and some of the faculty that were there when I was doing my master's, they jokingly said, oh, we'd never envisioned you to become a gene jockey. And said, yeah, there's things that happen and you really change a lot in life when it comes along. But it does give you a little bit different perspective. And, you know, I try to train the students that I'm working with now to think at so many different levels. You know, we can ask questions at the bench side of what's happened at the cellular level. But then I ask them, you know, what happens in the tissue? What happens in the whole cow? And then how does that impact the whole herd? And, you know, those are some of those grander challenges that we don't see a lot, or we don't see the training coming out like that as much anymore because of how funding is and so forth. And, So it's been a fun challenge.
So for the audience that may not be aware of the challenges with fescue, that maybe don't live in the Southeast or been around it much, you know, that's a massive issue in the Southeast of pregnancy rate losses, heat stress issues as well that fall into that. And it's a major economic decrease in production that really hurts a lot of beef producers. And I know North Carolina is one state that's shifted a lot of their calving seasons just to help deal with some of those issues. But a lot of producers don't think of a forage type that is, you know, the predominant, you know, 75% of the forages in the Southeast is going to be fescue. And it may or not be endophyte infected, but it can have a massive issue on their bottom line as a producer.
That's right. So the common fescue variety that causes the problem is Kentucky 31, and it gets its name from of how it was founded and when it was distributed. And for years, this grass provided a phenomenal resource to the producers. It's a very drought-tolerant grass. It's a heat-tolerant grass, and it resists a lot of herbivory. And so it is one that a lot of producers use. Because it's green 75% of the year and it'll grow in this area. It wasn't until I think the late 70s that they associated that the reason this grass is so persistent, and you know, I jokingly say it's the super grass of the South because of how well it does, is because it contains a fungus. And that fungus is what gives this grass its superpowers. And then we then learned that this fungus in that grass is what produces ergot alkaloids. And it's these ergot alkaloids that then negatively impact our ruminants, as well as horses. I don't study horses, so I'm, I know the literature, but it's not my area, but I do focus on the ruminant side and how it's impacting cattle and small ruminants. And as you mentioned, it does have a tremendous impact on the bottom line for our producers. The challenge that I think most producers have is they've lived with this grass for so many years that they don't see it as a problem. They don't see what it's doing. And one of the first field days we had, I had a pen of heifers that were consuming endophyte infected tall fescue beside a group of heifers that were consuming non-endophyte fescue. And, you know, the cattle that were on the endophyte infected grass, they had this field day was in our summertime. So they had long winter hair coats. They looked a little bit copper in color. They're black Angus cattle. So they had that reddish tint to them. You know, they're standing there panting, drooling, and they just looked uncomfortable. And then the group beside them, slicked out hair coat, nice and shiny, you know, look more comfortable. And everybody would come up to the pens and be like, well, what's wrong with those ones? And I said, well, there's nothing wrong with them. And I said, they're just consuming this. And well, my cattle don't look like that. And I said, well, go back and look at your cattle and think about these two images that you're seeing here today. And then all of a sudden it started to click. Yeah, their cattle do look like that, but all of them look like that. And so it wasn't that big of a difference until I, you know, they saw that visual. And then all of a sudden it becomes, all right, well, how do we fix it?
Yeah, like I say, it's a tremendous forage. And it's a tremendous asset because of the negative aspects of the forage, right? You can't overgraze it. You know, it's very persistent. But you do have those negative responses of lack of, you know, decreased average daily gain, decreased pregnancy rates. And for so long, producers didn't realize what they're giving up by having that.
You know, we do see those losses throughout the year. And you mentioned changing calving seasons, and that's been actually one of the most effective ways to improve our conditions here in the Southeast. So we know, looking at the profiles of when those ergot alkaloids are produced, we see the highest concentrations in the spring, and especially when those plants go to seed. In that seed head is where the highest concentration of ergot alkaloids are. And so if we're thinking about our normal calving system, or what calving system most of the country uses, they're calving in the spring, and then they're going to be rebreeding in May and June. And bam, that's right when those toxin loads or that ergot alkaloid load is the greatest. And so about 85% to 90% of our producers, at least in North Carolina, we've shifted to a fall calving system. So we're calving in September, October, and then we're going to be breeding those animals again in December and January when the when the ergot alkaloid concentration is the lowest in the year. And so that's really helped our scenario and helped those producers recover from that the effects of that ergot alkaloid toxin. You know, we mentioned about it's growing 75% of the year. We see it growing in the spring. And then one of the other advantages that we have is we do have a long grazing season, and we can actually stockpile this fescue into our fall months. And so we'll see a slight increase in the ergot alkaloid concentrations in September, October, November when it's getting cooler. But that forage as a stockpiled forage is a phenomenal resource. And many of our producers can graze 10, 11 months out of the year in a good year. Last year we had a drought, so it hurt us and we didn't see that type of grazing in a lot of producers. But most times we can extend that grazing season out, and that's one of the reasons why that forage is so phenomenal for us.
Oh, and you know, back to the comment of you do see that little spike again in that fall growing season of September, October, November. But the other aspect to that is it's not hot anymore, right?
Correct. There is an association with ambient temperatures, heat stress compounded with the ergot alkaloids is sort of that double whammy. So we think about what are those ergot alkaloids doing? Well, one of the things that we know that causes that decrease in performance is it ultimately causes vasoconstriction of the periphery. And so what that means is it's shrinking the blood vessels that it's going to the skin, to the tail, to the legs, or to the feet. And it's because of that vasoconstriction that these animals aren't able to shed that hair coat. So they're not able to properly manage their blood flow. You know, when we get hot, what's the first thing that happens? Most of us, we start sweating. Well, if we constrict the vasculature going to the skin, they're not able to properly dilate their vessels, and they're not able to dissipate that heat. And then you put them in a winter coat. And so that's where we're seeing that decrease in growth performance, and we see that decrease in reproductive performance. So one of the first things I did when I came to North Carolina, getting back to the ovary side of it, which has been my passion for years, is I asked a simple question of, do we see the same type of blood flow changes to the ovary that we do to the skin? We brought in 40 heifers from Montana that have never been exposed to endophyte infected tall fescue. We brought them in April, and I think those poor heifers thought they went to hell because it was a miserable summer. They were on toxic fescue, and they were really exhibiting the full symptoms of fescue toxicosis. The control group was perfectly fine. But we were able to show then that we see the same type of restriction in blood flow through the blood vessel diameter to the ovary that we see in the skin. And that's probably leading to some of those reproductive faults that we see in decreasing reproductive performance when these animals are consuming these ergot alkaloids.
Did you see the same result between the – adapted is the correct word, but because we know there's a genotype association with some adaption to fescue, but between those and the heifers coming from Montana,
there is that same type of trend. So animals that are that have been in this environment and more adapted to the ergot alkaloids in the fescue still have some constriction, but not as much. So we've also looked at some animals that are more heat tolerant. So we have a herd within our research system that has centipole influence genetics. And so these animals have the slick hair mutation. And this has been of interest that we asked the question, you know, the animals that are better able to handle the heat stress, are they better able to handle the ergot alkaloids? And in fact, they are. And so those animals with that slick haired mutation better tolerate the ergot alkaloids than animals that don't have that slick haired mutation. And so if they can counteract some of that heat stress, they can better handle those ergot alkaloids as well. And so that's been an interest of ours now, as we think about how do we help the producers. You know, American Angus put out a heat shedding EPD, which I know for a lot of folks across the country, that might not mean very much. But here in the Southeast, I think that's one of the key EPDs that we need to be looking at, especially if we have cattle on or consuming endophyte infested tall fescue.
So what other, and we talked a little bit about changing calving seasons, and we talked about, you know, hair shedding, et cetera. What other options do producers have to prevent or to treat some of these issues?
Great question. So the way that we approach it here at NC State is there's two different trains of thought. One train of thought that my good colleague Matt Poor does is, how do we change the environment that they're in? So how do we manage our pastures? How do we change the feed sources? Is there types of supplementation we can use? The other approach is what my lab does, and that is looking at the animal side of it. Are there things that we can change in the animal, or better identify animals that can tolerate the environment? So on the plant side, things that we know that help is, one is simple dilution. So if we have a field of Kentucky 31 fescue, if we interseed some clovers or some other legumes into that, we can dilute out that toxin load, provide a little bit extra protein, during that time when the ergot alkaloids are high, and that will help carry those cattle through until we get into our summer or warm season grasses. The other thing is, I mentioned protein. If we add a protein supplement, that tends to help as well, again, to carry those animals through. The challenge that, you know, we do see and we do run into is a lot of producers, especially east of the Mississippi, are leasing land. They don't own the land that they're running the cattle. And so it's really hard to make pasture management changes in that grouping. You know, in addition to adding the protein, some producers that do own a good bit of land are starting to renovate pastures to either clip the seed heads and do some seed head suppression. That'll mitigate or decrease some of the toxin load. And others are trying to figure out how to introduce a type of fescue plant that does not contain the endophyte that produces ergot alkaloids. So there's actually several different varieties of non-toxic fescue out there that we're trying to integrate. The challenge that we've ran into is that the Kentucky 31 is extremely persistent and it's extremely aggressive. And so when we renovate a pasture, we'll see encroachment of that Kentucky 31 over time. And that's hard to overcome. And so that's on the plant side, and little things add up and help tremendously. On the cattle side, my lab has been focused on trying to find animals that are tolerant to the toxins. And so we have a research herd that has been breeding cattle for over 100 years in our system on some of the hottest, or when I say hottest, some of the highest concentrations of ergot alkaloids in the system. They have not done any pasture renovation. And those animals thrive in that system. And we asked the question, why do some of them thrive and some of them fall out? And so we you know, specifically look at our 2 and 4 year old, our cows that are 2 to 4 years old. And that's really where we see that divergence in these animals. We have a strict calling procedure that if an animal does not become pregnant, they leave the farm. And so if they can't become pregnant in our system, they leave. And so those animals that continue to become pregnant within our system then stay. And so then we started looking at what are some features that allow these animals to develop in this environment. And that's really the direction that we've taken the last several years, trying to find indicators that will deem an animal as fescue tolerant. We've looked into some of the immune side, looking at how different cytokines or intercellular signals have might be changing. And while we have identified some that are related to the blood flow issues, that's not something that a producer can measure. And so we went back to the drawing board and said, okay, what are some of the things that we can do? We are looking at, you know, pedigrees and some of the genomic side to see if there are certain bloodlines that have influenced this area that tend to thrive a little bit more. And we're using some of the EPDs that are out there. In 2019, the pulmonary artery pressure EPD came out. And actually, that's what my one current student is just wrapping up. A lot of the symptoms that we see with high altitude disease out west mimic what we see in cattle that are experiencing fescue toxicosis. It's all related to blood flow. And with that EPD that came out in 2019, I thought, oh man, we got a magic bullet. Can we use that PAP EPD as a means to identify animals that are genetically tolerant to fescue? And so we've run a series of studies, you know, asking that, measuring pulmonary artery pressure. Now we are well below the 3,500 feet above sea level is the where we start to see that high altitude disease. So we don't have the altitude influence. But we also don't have that relationship that we anticipated with Fescue. Fortunately, the conversations that have came out have created a Fescue consortium that now we're a part of, and other states across the Southeast are participating in. And we're asking that question of, can we find animals that are Fescue tolerant? Some of your previous guests are part of that, and provide their insight and their expertise on that. And I think that's a goal that a lot of breed associations have and a lot of producers have, is, you know, getting to that genetic side of identifying those animals that are suitable or sustainable within the environment.
No, I think that's great. And, you know, one question I've always had is that, back to the adaptability standpoint, you know, there's a lot of AIing going on in the Southeast, right? And so if you're using bulls from whatever stud company you want to name that is in the Midwest, it's in the West, whatever, what is that doing to your offspring of that genetic selection and their ability to be adaptable to that? And I would guess that it decreases some of that adaptability of bringing in new genetics. It's never, even though you're just using, you know, semen from that. But I would guess you're still decreasing your adaptability over time by utilizing, you know, those AI studs.
That's right. And that's one of the hardest questions I get from producers, is when I'm at a meeting or so forth, and they're like, that we've spent all this money on this semen, and we bought one of the top sires out there, and boy, his calves look horrible. And I hate to hear that, but that's the truth. You know, 80% of our sires are coming out of the Midwest or in the Plains area. There are a few seed stock producers in the Southeast, but they're not many. And so we bring all these genetics in, and we bring them into an environment that the cattle have not been raised to and have not been adapted in. And we see a lot of them crash. And so that is a big challenge that a lot of times doesn't get reported. And so, you know, figuring out which sires do work in this environment has been a driving interest of ours. To try to help those producers figure out what will work, what will not work. And we have seen some bloodlines that do work from out there, in this area. And I'm not going to name any specific bulls. But we do know that some do work. So it is possible. And I like to tell the producers, well, that's where the research stations and the land grant comes in to make those mistakes for you, and figure that out. And that's sort of what my lab and some of the other folks here at NC State have tried to do for them.
Well, Dan, to wrap us up, anything that you want to touch on that we did not discuss?
So I think that even though this problem has been around for years, I think there's a bright future for it. Again, using new technologies to ask these type of questions, one of the things that we've been very fortunate in North Carolina have is a great relationship with the North Carolina Department of Ag. And we've recently had the investment in some precision data collection equipment now. And so we're able now to collect even better data on these animals in an environment that's hot and humid, and we expose them in an experimental system to the ergot alkaloids, to ask those questions, you know, what is it specifically doing to feed intake or water intake? And that has been really exciting, looking at some efficiency type of measurements that we haven't done in the past, with this newer technology. And so I think there's still a lot of questions out there. Unfortunately, I don't have that magic bullet for fescue toxicosis yet, but we're able to provide a lot more insight to our producers with the ability to continue to ask good questions and collect that data.
No, that's great. And that's definitely a massive challenge for those producers. And, you know, you touched on something earlier of saying that, you know, we've put a Band-Aid on this. And the problem is fescue is not going, or Kentucky 31 is not going away. And it's so persistent and so aggressive that it's going to be here And so, you know, finding those solutions that actually benefit long-term is very important.
That's right. I'm fortunate. Well, my wife and I are fortunate to have a farm in addition to working at the university. And when I'm out talking to producers, I have Kentucky 31 on my place. And the reason that I have it is because it is so robust. I can abuse it and I know it's still going to be there. And that's not a good mentality to have, but that's the world we're living in. And then so finding ways to manage around it and find those animals that are adapted to it, I think will be the key to be successful in maintaining the beef industry in the Southeast.
It's time for our famous three.
For over 60 years, bioMérieux has been a world leader in diagnostics, now revolutionizing the beef and meat industry with augmented diagnostics, addressing critical challenges such as food safety risks and recalls, production costs, and waste, as well as environmental and consumer concerns. bioMérieux offers a fresh approach that goes beyond test results. Their unique portfolio of microbiology testing, genomics, data solutions, and expert insights help with pathogen detection, enumeration, and root cause analyses. By providing improved risk anticipation and comprehensive data, bioMérieux empowers beef processors to confidently navigate today's complexities.
All right, to wrap us up, we've got three questions here. The first one is, what is your highly recommended beef resource, website, book, etc., that you highly recommend a producer or the audience of utilizing?
So even though I was trained in reproduction, I've really taken a liking to the proceedings of BIF, Beef Improvement Federation. They have a really good pulse on things, and have been able to participate in some of their meetings. And after participating in the meetings, I'm always asking more questions, which I think is phenomenal. And I think they do a lot for our producers in that guidance. So that's been one that I've really I reference a lot and I use a lot as we continue to expand our question base.
No, that's BIF or Beef Improvement is definitely one of a great conference, great proceedings for producers to actually utilize and get a lot of information from. So secondly is, what is a non-ag book do you highly recommend someone reading?
So I thought about this for a little while, and I want to tell you a little story first. So when I was working on my PhD with Dr. Pate, she encouraged me to read the Harry Potter series. And I laughed when she first said it because I was like, oh, that's some kid book. And I literally, that was my response. And she's like, no, I want you to read it because there's a lot of life lessons in there. There's a lot of things to think about, and it's going to help improve your way of looking at things. And so I started on that. You know, you listen to your advisors, and I started reading it, and then it became very addictive, and it actually really increased my overall interest in reading. And so now I'm a very avid reader. I have three children, and I'm, you know, getting them excited about reading as well. And my oldest is, I think, on book four of the Harry Potter series. I won't let her watch the movies until she finishes the books. And so that has been one that has by far one that I'll continue to read. And you always pick up something up a little bit different. But I always thought it was odd that my PhD mentor was the one that introduced me to a children's book.
That is a book I did not expect. I have not read it, but I may have to look into it then. So lastly, in your opinion, what sets apart a highly successful beef professional versus, you know, someone that isn't?
Yeah, with this one, I was always encouraged, and I encourage my students and anybody I interact with, is to find that question that really excites you. And then it's really your work ethic and your enthusiasm that's going to excel you in your career. There's a lot of quotes out of Ohio State, and one that sticks with me is that there are a lot of smart people out there, but if you find somebody that or there's a lot of smart people out there, but if you can work harder than them, you're going to get a lot further. And that's sort of been my mentality. I've been around a lot of smart people in my life. But as long as you have that hard work ethic and enthusiasm for what you're doing, you're going to excel.
Oh, that's great. That's a great response. Well, Dan, thank you for the time. Really appreciate it. A lot of cool stuff you guys got going on with Vescue and try to overcome some of those challenges.
Well, I thank you for having me on. It's a great podcast and I appreciate it.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.